So this is interesting to be talking about tobacco control at the local level, hear what some of the struggles are. And these are struggles that our public health communities and our communities at large have faced here within the United States, where the work that we do is pretty safe. If you think about public health workers beyond the borders of the U.S. and in some economically poor countries or developing countries, what's at stake is much different. And the tactics, the fear-based tactics that the industry is often using in our communities here, you can just imagine the magnification of that fear in other places where protections aren't quite as solid as they are here. So anyway, it's the stories that each of you have told are, I think, daunting, and for me brings this whole conversation about tobacco control operating from an international regulatory framework that provides protections for everyone is absolutely essential. So my presentation is hopefully short enough. I tend to add commentary a lot along the way, as I'm doing now. But I will start out just by saying that I have nothing to disclose. Maybe this won't work. There we go. No relationships to disclose. So the introduction, we talked about the organization Corporate Accountability International. So we are a membership organization. 75 to 90% of our funding on an annual basis comes from individuals. So that provides us with an incredible amount of freedom to actually name names, name corporate names, talk about Philip Morris, talk about Altria, talk about British American Tobacco, Japan Tobacco, when the need arises. So we don't have to shy away, and we're not constrained by really pointing the finger where the finger needs to be pointed. So we're really very lucky in that way. Many of you who have been in the public health community for a long time will know this organization because our work years ago around infant formula marketing. You remember the Nestle boycott? Yeah, so raise your hand if you were a Nestle boycotter. We started out as the Infant Formula Action Coalition, and we're formed out of the University of Minnesota by students. So for the past 35 years, we've had a rich tradition of working with campus groups, faith-based communities, and actually from the very beginning with the American Public Health Association. So it's pretty nice to be amongst friends and peers in lots of different places that we work. The organization is in official relations with three different UN agencies, including the World Health Organization, and that relationship started actually around the infant formula campaign. It was the first time that WHO in the late 70s and early 80s took on an issue related to a commercial product. The hope at the time was that there would be a legally binding framework around how infant formula could be marketed, but there was insubstantial political will to push that forward. So when you fast forward to 1996, when the Director General of the World Health Organization was a pediatrician from Norway, Dr. Gro Harlem Brundtland, we learned that, gosh, if you really have a strong backbone, you can actually make things happen. Dr. Brundtland said, look, smoking is a preventable epidemic, and we have to do something that puts in place legally binding structures to save lives. And that kicked off a process that I'm going to talk a little bit more about today. I just want to point out, though, the other work that we do a lot of public education in this organization around public health, human rights, and environmental safety, and the role that transnational corporations play in affecting those arenas. The three major campaigns we work on are on tobacco and pursuing the comprehensive enforcement of and implementation of the Global Tobacco Treaty. We also work on a campaign, Value the Meal, to protect good food, and also a campaign on water to both establish and implement the human right to water globally. So we cover a range of public health issues. I mentioned that it was 1996 that WHO first decided that they could do something about tobacco. That began a pretty long process within the World Health Organization to put in place the Global Tobacco Treaty. In 2001, just a couple of years into the work, it was extremely apparent that the leading obstacle to putting this treaty in place would be the tobacco industry. So in 2001, the World Health Assembly adopted a piece of essentially a guiding principle that said that the tobacco industry's role in all public policy should be exposed. Not prohibited, but exposed. So we would start every meeting with a question, who here represents the tobacco industry or has any dealings with them? So I just wanted to ask that question here. Is anyone here directly connected to the tobacco industry or any of their subsidiaries or trade associations? Okay, this might be a first. Amazing. A couple of years after that piece of guiding principle was established in 2003, the World Health Assembly, which is 192 nations of the world that govern the World Health Organization, adopted unanimously the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. Even the United States, which had been a part of the discussion since 1996 and who was very much an obstacle at practically every juncture, honestly, even the United States voted to adopt the treaty in 2003, which was a huge, huge accomplishment for the global public health community. And Rachel mentioned that over 170 countries have ratified. So 173 nations have ratified the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, plus the European Union. The United States did sign the treaty under the Bush administration, in large part to improve our political standing in the global community around the Second Gulf War, but then took that treaty and locked it in a bottom drawer at the State Department, where it remains today. So 87%, in spite of the U.S. not ratifying, 87% of the world's population is protected by the Global Tobacco Treaty. How these kinds of stories then continue to play out, well, in the U.S. we can say that's because we haven't ratified and implemented the treaty. In other parts of the world, we can say the same thing. And even in the places where the treaty has been ratified, we have to recognize that it's then up to national laws to be established and figure out how to implement and enforce those. So all the work that we're doing domestically at every level, community, city, state, federal, those are setting and establishing or even testing out very critical policies that can be used and implemented in the global community, which is, so it's even in spite of the U.S. not ratifying, the work that we do here really pays off globally to protect lives. So the three key areas here that I wanted to just share are a little bit about the U.S. involvement in the treaty, talk about the potential impact of the U.S. government ratifying the treaty, and then talk a little bit more about the possibilities for U.S. ratification, which just sort of at first brush seem to be a long shot, even with the current administration. So every year, and some of you may already know this, but every year tobacco kills nearly 6 million people worldwide. That's one person. That's today, 2011. Every 6 seconds, somebody dies from a tobacco-related illness. Every 6 seconds. Ugh. If these trends continue, that will mean up to 1 billion people die from a tobacco-related illness in this century. 1 billion people. The crisis is devastating, obviously. The thing about it is, and you all know this better than most, it's preventable. This is a preventable epidemic. Tobacco-related illnesses represent the single largest preventable cause of death and disease on the planet, with nearly 80% of the deaths coming from developing countries. This is a corporate-driven epidemic, right? Tobacco is one of the most profitable products on the world market. Thus, the engagement and every community level around by the tobacco industry, they're there to protect their profits. The tobacco industry spends, just in the United States alone, $12.8 billion every year marketing its products. That is $3.5 million a day on tobacco marketing. $3.5 million. We were super excited to hear about the $10 million grant for Seattle and King County over 2 years, right? Every day. They spend that in just 3 days. Pause, grunt. That's shocking. So if you go outside of the borders of the U.S., there are even more limited resources to prevent the tobacco industry from expanding, which is a very important reason that this tobacco treaty was so essential. From the very thought that the World Health Organization could, for the first time in its history, implement binding health policy this seemed to be the most essential step for the WHO to take. If you look at the just the big three tobacco corporations, so British American Tobacco, Philip Morris International, and Japan Tobacco, in 2009, their combined revenues were $190 billion. I have a list here of 13 countries whose gross domestic product don't even add up to that number. I won't read them off to you, but if you want to hear them after, let me know. We could actually take a little spotlight and travel around the map of the world and pick out groupings of countries who together, their muscle doesn't add up to the same muscle of the leading three tobacco corporations. So when the World Health Organization said, you know, we need to do this, it was really the thought that the public health impact when combined, if we put it all together, we could actually take on the economic power and the influence of big tobacco. So today, after the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control was adopted, we now have the first ever public health and corporate accountability treaty that's ever been established. This, the treaty, 10 minutes, let me just pause for a second here. I guess I should talk a little bit about just what the treaty does, what its impact will be, and then how tobacco is really, the industry itself is one of the greatest threats to the treaty realizing its full potential. So there are, I would say, five key provisions in the Global Tobacco Treaty. The treaty calls for a comprehensive ban on tobacco marketing, sponsorship, and promotion. It also has a very groundbreaking provision called Article 5.3 that prevents the tobacco industry from interfering in or participating in public health policymaking. Can you imagine if the industry was not allowed into the room, not allowed to open their mouth, not allowed to hand over a policy to one of our elected officials that they wanted to see put in place? That's what Article 5.3 protects us from. There's monitoring disclosure of tobacco industry activities required across the board, holding the tobacco corporations liable for the harms they cause. So financially, having the industry pay for what they've caused, that would be hugely beneficial in the United States. And then prioritizing public health over trade and commercial interests. The actual preamble to this treaty, and this was, I will say, one of the most controversial parts of the treaty negotiations over the many years that it was negotiated, is the treaty opens and it actually starts with a line that says, public health shall be the priority. This is from an international legal perspective, this is hugely groundbreaking. Imagine if we could walk into a room as a public health worker, a public health official, or even just a mom or a dad committed to public health, and know that your concerns about public health are the number one concern. It's not an economic concern, that's secondary or third. It's not a trade issue, second or third. It's not to protect the rights of the tobacco corporations, they're way down, but it's a public health priority. This treaty establishes that. Which is pretty amazing, and knock wood, has yet to be challenged in any international court. There are many other provisions in the treaty. There are over 30 different provisions. So all the different pieces we talked about today are essentially addressed within the treaty. I want to just say a few more. Protection from exposure to tobacco smoke, ensuring effective health warnings and messages on tobacco product packaging and labeling, establishing pricing and tax measures to reduce the demand for tobacco, establishing programs that promote tobacco cessation and treatment for tobacco addiction. So there's a lot of overlap here. Prohibiting the sale of tobacco to and by minors. We've made a lot of progress on that in this country, but that's not the case everywhere. In some countries, this is an older story, but in Indonesia for years, there was a whole group of little kids, 4 to 11 years old, I think was the range. They were employed, they were called jump boys, and their job was to jump in and out of traffic during rush hour selling individual cigarettes. It still happens. And then also another one just to mention is regulating tobacco product flavorings and disclosures. So once implemented, this treaty can save up to 200 million lives by the year 2050. That's not very long away. And the greatest threat to realizing this potential is the tobacco industry's access, influence, and clout, really. So I talked a little bit about the treaty coming together in 96, adopted in 2003, and there are today really only a handful of countries that have not yet ratified. The U.S. and Indonesia are two of the biggest. We're two of the biggest population centers that are left unprotected, essentially. You all are, I'm sure, familiar with the Master Tobacco Settlement that was negotiated in the U.S. in the late 90s, is that right? Thank you, mid-90s. And then the Minnesota Legal Settlement that forced the release of millions of pages of internal tobacco industry documents. That, for us and for many of our international allies, is a huge resource. How many folks use the Document Center for their work? A fair number of us. It's extremely valuable legal precedent or piece of legal work that was done to help all of us with our public health work. And just to give a little more background, you know, it's awful hearing about the access that the industry has to affect the work that we're doing today, again, even in the U.S. But this dates back to the 50s, remember, when several of the largest tobacco firms teamed up with a PR firm to create the Tobacco Institute. Remember the good old Tobacco Institute, which was a lobbying arm for the industry? And they also created the Council on Tobacco Research, which was the vehicle that the tobacco industry used for years, creating junk science. So they had their lobbying arm, they had their junk science, and the lobbying arm would use the junk science to promote and build their cases. A lot of this is still happening in communities locally, particularly around the economic issues. So the tobacco industry uses the restaurant associations, other industry trade groups, to move into communities where the public health community is active to try to preempt what good work we're doing, what impact that can have. It's, they've been experts at it really for like 60 years. I hope you both know that, all know that both the Council on Tobacco Research and the Tobacco Institute were closed down. Nonetheless, they still have their ways and they're out there working aggressively to continue to influence policy. So let's see. There are a lot of ways to work within the international arena. I don't think the focus here is really about how to get that work done, but more I think the question for us is, should the U.S. ratify this treaty? And I'm running out of time, I know. So I'm just going to move over here. There are some disadvantages, we'll start there, to the U.S. ratifying the tobacco treaty. The first is that there is a very dangerous loophole that was created when our national law established by the FDA, the FDA established the Tobacco Product Scientific Advisory Committee as part of the Family Smoking and Prevention Act. And do you know that Lorillard was the first company to get a seat on that advisory committee? And what they were taking up on the advisory committee was whether or not to regulate the menthol in cigarettes. Lorillard is the maker of Newport, right, the leading menthol cigarette. So needless to say, we have not yet seen a ruling on whether menthol cigarettes would be ditched or not, thanks to the tobacco industry. But if the U.S. was a party to the tobacco treaty, that type of involvement by the industry would be prevented. So we have a lot of work to do, even though we do have some very good national health policy. The advantages around ratifying the treaty are much deeper than not. They would provide an excellent legal forum and framework for all of the work we do domestically, at every level. The U.S. would also bring much-needed technical and financial resources to the international community around tobacco control. The coordinating body for the treaty in the 2012-2013 year, the annual budget for the governing body for 173 countries having ratified is not quite $14 million. It's not very much money. If the U.S. ratified, because of the way the fees are assessed through the U.N. system, that would add at least an additional $3 million to that budget. It's not a lot of money, but in this arena, a little bit of money goes a long way, much different than how we spend money domestically. I also wanted to say that the U.S., while often is operating internationally in particular on behalf of the tobacco industry, sadly, when we are at any negotiations, any parts of negotiating conventions to this treaty or implementing phases to this treaty, the U.S. often is there representing the interests of Big Tobacco. But they also, there are very good people, right, people like us, that are making these negotiations happen. So sometimes we'll step out and provide inspiring workarounds to how you can implement the treaty in your own country. And I think the notion of having the U.S. ratify and then support that work that we're doing in our own communities is essential. So I'm going to, I think, wrap up with my two-minute warning here. I'd like to ask all of you, though, to just do a little bit and help us send a message to President Obama, urging him to unlock the treaty and send it over to the Senate for ratification. It would go from the State Department to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and then from the Foreign Relations Committee to the floor of the Senate, where we would need 2/3 majority vote. So the road to treaty ratification here is long, but absolutely possible. So do I have questions here? Yeah.
So my understanding is part of the roadblock is that Senator Kerry won't consider the treaties until the law of the sea treaties out of the way. That's not just the FCPC, but any treaty. Have you guys heard that at all?
We haven't heard that particular thing. We know that there are, it seems like they sort of have a list of what's coming, and we know this is on the list, but it seems like it's a little further down.
And then when you say that the tobacco industry in international trade is being represented by the U.S., could you clarify what you mean by that? Those of us who work in public health agencies in the U.S. might be a little concerned about that.
Well, you should be concerned about it, but when we look at who the U.S. government sends to these international treaty meetings, often they're from, often they're not big teams made up of the Health and Human Services. They're lawyers from trade, they're lawyers from ag, they're lawyers from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So it is a concern. We can talk more about who's represented there, but it's...
That's not my experience in the case of the U.S. patent against Indonesia. And before the WTO, there was the FDA and USCTC, we were very involved in that problem.
There are absolutely brilliant and committed tobacco control advocates from the U.S. that work within this arena. There have to be. But when push comes to shove, and it's about whether or not we will ensure that the treaty does, in fact, prioritize health over trade, the U.S. was the biggest obstacle throughout every single part of that discussion. And it wasn't people from the CDC or Health and Human Services. It's the lawyers that are there operating on behalf of the trade rights of the tobacco industry. So I don't mean to condemn the entire, every civil worker, but I think we have to really point fingers when we have the opportunity to. And we know full well that the tobacco industry is extremely aggressive and capable at influencing our policymakers. Other questions?
Well, thank you, Kelly, and to the rest of the panelists. Those were great presentations. We do have about 2 minutes for questions for the group. So anyone have any questions that you didn't get to ask earlier? Now is the time. Or you can all run and get your coffee. Seems to be. Okay. I think we'll be up here for a little while, so if you have any questions that you don't want to ask in front of your colleagues, feel free to come up to the front of the room. Thank you.